A Shadow of Good Things to Come. That's the name of a series of lessons we have been doing from the Old Testament. For someone not used to reading the Bible, it may be something of a surprise that the Bible is broken into two parts, Old Testament and New. What may be even the bigger surprise is that as long ago as the Old Testament was written, and for a much longer period of time before the New Testament, nevertheless, many things in the Old Testament pointed to things that were going to happen in the New. Now, from time to time, our world is sort of dazzled for a brief time by those who claim to be prophets or seers or those who can predict the future. But we quickly become disenchanted with them because if they ever hit it right, it seems to be by accident. And the majority of the time, they get it totally wrong. And yet here we have a record that's been preserved for thousands of years called the Old Testament. The first parts of it written as long ago perhaps as 1800 B.C. And the very last part of it written no later than 400 B.C. And yet throughout that great writing, 39 different documents, books, each one of them talking in its own way, not only of what's happening then, but what's going to come in the future. And then when we get to our New Testament, covering the period of time from just before Jesus' birth around 4 B.C. until the end of the New Testament period of time around maybe 90 or 95 A.D. We see so many things happening there, so many events, so many fulfillments of the things in the old. So much so that the Hebrew writer says in Hebrews chapter 10 and verse 1, that many of those things we read about in the Old Testament were a shadow of the good things to come. That's rather unique in human history, that something can be predicted over and over for hundreds of years and then it come to pass. But not just one thing, dozens of things, hundreds of things foretold and then fulfilled. And what we've done is for the last 24 lessons. I told you when we began this that I didn't know how long we would continue it. But so far we've had 24 lessons on a shadow of good things to come. Today is number 25. We have two more after this and we'll be done. We haven't exhausted the subject. We've just exhausted ourselves. And it's time to move on to other things. But in those 24 lessons so far, we have seen how in the Old Testament, God working through those people in almost everything they did, in the people who led them, in the ceremonies they practiced, in the laws that God gave them, in the hope they held for the future, God was pointing to what was going to happen in the New Testament. Now they sensed, some to a greater degree than others, but they all sensed that God was doing that. In fact, He told them He was doing that. But still, when these things started to actually transpire, not just the promise of them, but the actual fulfillment of them in the life and teachings and so forth of Jesus, they had a hard time seeing it. That's why in our passage we read at the beginning of the service this morning, in Luke 24, we hear Jesus saying what He did. By the time we get to Luke chapter 24, Jesus has, of course, not only been born and grown up, begun His ministry, gone about doing miracles, teaching, coming into conflict with the religious leaders of His nation, the Jewish people. He's been crucified. He's been buried. He's risen from the dead. And after His resurrection, He's meeting with some of His disciples. And He is still surprised that they're surprised. He is disturbed that they didn't see it coming. He can't understand, in a sense, how they could have missed it. And that's why we hear Him saying what we read in Luke 24, verse 25. He said to them, "How foolish you are, and how slow of heart to believe all that the prophets have spoken. Did not the Christ have to suffer these things and then enter His glory? And beginning with Moses and all the prophets, He explained to them what was said in all the Scriptures concerning Himself." Notice as Luke records this event here, he says that Jesus said that starting with Moses, the first five books of the Old Testament were all written by Moses. Starting with Moses and all the prophets, the last 17 books of the Old Testament are specifically the writings of the prophets. But in addition to that, you have David, who in addition to being a king was called a prophet, and Solomon, who also is designated as a prophet. He wrote at least two, I guess, of the books of the Old Testament and others. Jesus said that starting with Moses and all the prophets, they said these things had to happen. And yet somehow by the time Jesus came, the Jewish people had all focused on just one aspect of those promises. And that is that God would raise up a king for them who would give them victory over their enemies. They skipped everything else. Now, children often do that. They have selective hearing. Now, some wives think their husbands do too. But, you know, children particularly have sort of selective hearing. They hear the good things they wanted to hear sometimes and manage to dial out or tune out that which was not what they wanted to hear. Jesus implies that's what the people of His day had done. We don't want to be the same way. So we have taken our time to try to go back and see some of the things that Moses and all the prophets said. After what Jesus says here, He meets with all of His disciples. At this point, He's only meeting with two of them. Later that same day, He meets with 10 more of them. The only one missing that day, apparently, was Thomas. And He'll meet with him the next week. But later down in Luke chapter 24, Jesus has met with them that night in the upper room. He shows them His hands and His feet. That's because there would be the nail holes still in His hands and in His feet where He had been nailed to the cross. That was His way of proving who He was to them, that this is the same one they saw crucified just a few days before. He showed them these things and they found it hard to believe, even though they were filled with joy and amazement. And why wouldn't they? All of us have lost loved ones, people who were very dear to us. We know when they died, we attended their funerals, we perhaps even still visit their grave from time to time. How hard would we find it to believe if they suddenly rose from the dead and presented themselves to us again? The difference is Jesus had told them at least 8 times before it happened that He would do that, and they still couldn't believe it. He had done all sorts of miracles, shown His power over sickness and death and nature and weather and all sorts of things, and they still couldn't believe it. It's just too incredible to believe. That's why so much evidence is given to us in the New Testament that it really did happen. But as He's meeting with them that night and showing them these things, He says to them down in Luke 24:44, "This is what I told you while I was still with you. Everything must be fulfilled that is written about me in the law of Moses, the prophets, and the Psalms." Then He opened their minds so they could understand the Scriptures. He's still opening our minds today so we can understand what God had prepared in advance concerning His Son. Now, if God did give men of the Old Testament the words to speak and the words to write that became the Old Testament, and He did, through those words, foretell these events, what does that tell us? Well, first of all, it tells us God foreknew these things would happen. And He told it ahead of time, so there would be no doubt but that He foreknew. For human beings by themselves, the only kind of foretelling we can do is after the event, and that's really not foretelling, is it? Someone has said that only hindsight is 20/20. That is, only as we look back can we infallibly know what's going to happen. We just, by ourselves, don't have the power to know the future, but God does. And if He did reveal these things in the Old Testament, then that means He foreknew, He knew ahead of time they would happen. And not by hours or days or weeks, but by centuries. He knew. But more than just foreknew, it therefore means that what did end up happening was no accident. It was pre-planned by God. You'll actually find some religious teachers today who will say that in the New Testament some things happened that caught Jesus by surprise, and so he had to change his plans. Nonsense. God foretold by centuries those things would happen. It caught God not by surprise, but it all fit according to the plan. So he foreknew it. He was not caught by surprise by it. It was his divine intent that it happened that way. That Jesus was rejected by the Jewish people, that wasn't a surprise to God. He foretold it. That he was crucified, that didn't catch God by surprise. He foretold it. That the gospel received a greater reception among non-Jewish people, the Gentiles, than it did among the Jews, that didn't catch God by surprise. He foretold it. It was God's divine intent. It also tells us then that while the vast majority of all human written records over the centuries have disappeared, that God divinely preserved these records so we could know that. Some people today say, well, if God was doing all these things, why didn't he give us some evidence of it? We have it. We have the divine preservation of a record that otherwise would have passed into oblivion like most other records written by human beings over the centuries have. But this one has been preserved. It lets us know not only what God did, but what he was going to do. We have the record. We want to take a few moments this morning now to pass one last time over a part of the Old Testament. I like to imagine in my mind that as we open up the Scriptures here, as we go back now to Genesis, that even as we open up the pages of this first book of the Bible, a shadow is passing over it. A shadow of the Son of God. A shadow of a cross. A shadow of a way of redeeming man from his sin. For the Scriptures say that what was happening up here in the future cast a shadow back across all of these things. There's no way we could identify all the things. I'm confident that once we actually get to heaven, if we want to know it, that God can hold an advanced class in understanding the Old Testament, in which he can show us all the things he put back there that pointed ahead to his Son. I told someone this past week as I was talking to them about this series we're doing here, I said that God wanted people to know that this is what he planned to do, and so he put all these signs back in the Old Testament. Everywhere you look, they were all pointing to the future. And it reminded me of the story that I've heard in various forms. So I don't know which form of it is the accurate one, but hopefully one of them is that a young man was alienated from his family. He had a falling out with his father, and he had stormed out of the house and left the community where they lived and gone out to seek his fortune by himself in the world. And over the years, good things and bad had happened to him, but his conscience always ached, knowing that he had left behind a family that really loved him and cared for him, but because in anger and disagreement that he had broken those ties. And so the story says that finally, once when he had a trip planned that was going to take him by train, this was obviously before the days of airplanes and so forth, take him by train right through the very town where he grew up, that the train would stop there for a few moments. But he rode ahead, just hoping that the letter would arrive to his family's house. And he said that, you know, that he's been gone a long, long time, and he deeply regrets a lot of the things that were said and done at that time. And he sure would like to see them again. And if that might be possible, on the outskirts of town right by the railroad tracks was an old oak tree. And if they could just tie a yellow ribbon in that tree where he could see it as he come by on the train, he would know to get off when it stopped. He was looking for a sign, some indication of what their intent was. And as the story goes, as the train starts approaching the town, every tree, every fence post had a yellow ribbon tied on it. If people were looking for God's intent, in the Old Testament, everywhere we look, there are signs pointing to what his intention was. And Jesus says that all those signs were pointing to him. And so as we turn back to Genesis, we just briefly look at part of the Old Testament this morning. And as we walk our way through Genesis, we see in God's creation of the world, already, we're seeing Jesus. For in the New Testament, Jesus said that He was that creative force. John chapter 1 starts with that. Paul, in his writing to the Colossians and explaining to them how Jesus was that fulfillment, says that everything that has been made was made by Him. And He not only made it, He sustains it. And then we see Jesus in Adam and Eve. For we see the very first man made perfect in the eyes of God. In the New Testament, we're told that Jesus was the new Adam, the second Adam, the new perfect man. For the first one fell into sin and disobeyed God. The second one did not. We see them have children, and we see God calling on those sons of theirs to offer sacrifice to God. Why sacrifice? Apparently for their sins. And already we see then that God one day would offer His own Son as a sacrifice for all the sins of all the world. We go a little further in the book of Genesis. We get down to about chapter 5, and we meet a man by the name of Noah. The world has become so wicked that it essentially says that all the thoughts of all mankind was continually on that which was wrong and wicked, except for Noah and his family. And God has him build a great ark, a way of preserving not only his family, but representative animals from all of the animal kingdom, because God is going to destroy the whole world with a great flood. And how could they know at that time that God was symbolizing by that one day people would be saved by water again? As Peter says in 1 Peter chapter 3, in the same way, baptism also saves us. We're not making this up. We're learning that God put it there that way. And that God destroyed the world by water then indicated that God will only destroy the world one more time, this time by fire, at the end of the world when Jesus comes back again. Then we meet Abraham. Abraham, a man who loved God and believed God and trusted God. And so he went where God told him to go and did what God told him to do. And God told Abraham that He was going to bless him and his descendants. So he'd have a great family of descendants. And that through his family, all nations of the earth would be blessed. And yet Abraham didn't even have any children. That's in Genesis chapter 12. I will make you into a great nation, and I will bless you. I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and whoever curses you, I will curse. And all peoples on earth will be blessed through you. And yet Abraham had no children. And then at last he had one son through his wife Sarah. They named him Isaac. It's very interesting. The scriptures say of that son that he was the one and only son, the one and unique son of Abraham. And then over in the New Testament, it talks about Jesus and says he was the one and only son of God. Use the same terminology. And yet it was through this one son, Isaac, that then Isaac had two sons, Jacob and Esau, and through one of those sons, Jacob, he had 12 sons. And eventually through those 12 sons comes the entire nation of the Jewish people. And when we get to the New Testament, we see Jesus, and what do we see? Both in Matthew's Gospel and in Luke's Gospel, we see the lineage of Jesus tracing directly straight back through Abraham. Jesus was a direct descendant of Abraham through Isaac, through Jacob, through Judah, right on down the line. How many more stories could we find out of Genesis that find a connection in the New Testament? Some of them were prophetic, some were symbolic, some were just typical, that is, they were a picture of something that would happen again. We just pause briefly with one of the sons of Jacob towards the end of the book of Genesis. Jacob is old and about to die, and he's called his sons into them to give them his blessing. This was a part of their culture. For fathers near their death to call in their sons and give each one of them a blessing. And when he calls to him his son Judah, in Genesis 49 and verse 9, he says, O Judah, you are a lion's cub. You are the cub of a lion. Later prophets would talk about the coming of the Messiah and call him the lion of the tribe of Judah. And yet here's the Father, long before there is any tribe of Judah, telling His Son, "You are a lion's cub. You return from the prey, My Son, like a lion who crouches and lies down, like a lioness who dares to rouse him." And He says, "The scepter." Now that's a very unusual thing, because here's a rural people, they were, to put it bluntly, they were sheep herders, goat herders. That's how they made their living. They didn't even till the soil. They were a wandering nomadic people at this time. And yet Jacob says to one of his sons, he says, "The king's scepter will not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until he comes to whom it belongs, and the obedience of the nations will be his." So here's an old sheep herder telling his son, a sheep herder, that through him will come kings. And king after king will reign until finally comes the one who rightfully can be king, and then he'll be king over all the nations. I do not believe we can find a nation on earth today where there are not at least some people who acknowledge Jesus as king. He is king over all the nations. And he is a direct descendant of Judah. The shadow of Jesus passing over the book of Genesis. Then we move to Exodus. We don't have time for all of it, do we? But you're seeing where this is going. In the book of Exodus, this Jewish family of sons and brothers go down to Egypt and live down there for 400 years. And they go from a family of some 70 people into a nation of 2 to 3 million people. During that time, things change in Egypt, and no longer are they welcomed by their host family. They become the slave labor part of their society. And God raises up a man by the name of Moses to lead them out of Egypt. In the New Testament, soon after Jesus was born, it became necessary for his family to flee from old King Herod and go down to Egypt for a while. And as they came back up out of Egypt, back to the land where the Jewish people lived, it is said that out of Egypt have I called my son. What happened to the Jewish people way back in the days of Moses became a type of what would happen to Jesus in the new. And the scriptures say that's no accident. That's not just coincidental that those two things look so much alike. But he raises up a deliverer for them, one called Moses, a man who was devoted and dedicated to God. He leads them out and across the Red Sea, and again, we have them being saved by water. And he takes them down to a mountain called Sinai, and there God comes down and meets with them, and he gives them his law, and he tells them how they can live acceptably and pleasing to him. And the scriptures tell us in the book of Hebrews that we also have come to a mountain, but not Sinai. We've come to a mountain called Mount Zion, the heavenly Jerusalem, and God lives there. And he lives with us, his people. And he gives us his law. And we worship and serve him. Again, not coincidental. They wander in the wilderness for some 40 years. Once while they were out there, they disobeyed God so grievously that he allowed snakes, serpents that lived in that area of the desert to bite many of them. And people were dying from the snake bites. And then God had Moses make a pole and make a brass image of a serpent and put it up on that pole and hold it up over the camp, and anyone who would turn and look at the snake on the pole wouldn't die from the snake bite. Interesting story, kind of strange. But so what? Jesus himself said in John chapter 3, "Just like Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, so I will be lifted up and draw all men to myself." Already we see a type of the crucifixion of Jesus in the book of Exodus. It goes on. We can go to Leviticus. We've spent several weeks talking about the priesthood that God set up for the Jewish people and how Jesus was a fulfillment of that. He is the true priest. How God gave them their annual holy days, feast days to keep, and how each one of those, Pentecost, unleavened bread, first fruits, atonement, tabernacles, every one of them pointed to Jesus, someone to come and something still to come. In the book of Numbers, We find them wandering for those 40 years. In Deuteronomy, as Moses is dying, he knows he won't go into the promised land with them, but he'll die before he goes in. He repeats to them all the law that God had given them and tells them that one day, in Deuteronomy 18, he says, one day God will raise up someone else like me. And when he comes, listen to him in everything he says. The shadow passes across Deuteronomy. In the New Testament, in John chapter 5, Jesus is talking to the Jewish people of his day. And he says to them in John chapter 5, and in verse 39, you diligently study the scriptures because you think that by them you possess eternal life. These are the scriptures that testify about me, yet you refuse to come to me to have life. That's a very interesting thing that had happened by the time Jesus came. In the Jewish religion, there were two great groups. They weren't all the groups there were. You know, they had sort of denominations even among the Jewish people. They had the Sadducees and they had the Pharisees. These were the two largest groups. Now, the Pharisees believed all the Old Testament, from Genesis to Malachi, we would say, were inspired by God and should be obeyed. But the Sadducees didn't believe that. The Sadducees believed only the first five books of the Old Testament, Genesis through Deuteronomy, were actually inspired by God. That the other books were okay. They were good guidelines for life, good history about the Jewish people, but they didn't hold the same weight as the first five books, the books of Moses, did. So here Jesus is talking to a combined group of both Pharisees and Sadducees, those that believed all the Old Testament, and then those who only believed the first five books should be treated as the Word of God. And so first he says here that these scriptures testify about me. He's telling them the same thing we've been saying this morning and for the last 24 weeks. These scriptures were talking about the one to come. But maybe there were some of the Sadducees, I'm just supposing. Some of the Sadducees out there in his audience who were saying, well, maybe the Pharisees believe that, but we don't. Because after all, we only accept the books of Moses, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. And so Jesus says in verse 45, but do not think I will accuse you before the Father. Your accuser is Moses. Jesus tells them, he says, Moses is accusing you of not listening. And the only way Moses could be doing that is if Moses somehow in those first five books also talked about him. Your accuser is Moses, on whom your hopes are set. If you believed Moses, you would believe me, for he wrote about me. See what Jesus is doing? He left them no out. He gave them no room to deny that the Scriptures talked about him. Whether they only accept the first five books or all of them. Then we have Joshua. The neat thing to me about Joshua is that Joshua had the same name Jesus did. We don't say that very often, but you know, Azu is really Greek. And I know that when Jesus was growing up in his home in Nazareth, when the angel told Joseph to give this child that's going to be born the name, that he didn't say call him Jesus. It's just because the New Testament was written in the Greek language, we even know that he's called that. In the Hebrew language and in the Aramaic language that was derived from the Hebrew language, his name was Yeshua, Joshua. And so we have this great man of the Old Testament named Joshua, a great leader and deliverer of the people. And even his name became prophetic of the one who was to come. And Joshua leads the people across the Jordan River into the promised land, and that's what Jesus says he's doing for us, is taking us to the land that's been promised to us. Joshua wanted to give them rest. He wanted them to at last be free from their slavery and free from their wanderings in the desert and wilderness by taking them to that land, and they would settle down there and have rest. And the book of Hebrews says, but Joshua couldn't give them rest. And so we're still looking for the rest that comes in Jesus. After they cross that Jordan River, the first thing they come up against is a great citadel of Jericho, a fortress city there to protect that entrance into the land of promise. And as Joshua is there looking at it and trying to figure out how are they going to conquer that, because if they don't conquer it, nothing else will work. Suddenly he realizes someone is there beside him. He turns around and looks and even grabs his sword. to defend himself, or he's probably thinking it's someone from Jericho, some scout, some soldier out who's discovered him. And Joshua says, are you for us or for them? And this individual says, neither. But as the captain of the armies of God, I come. In the New Testament, and elsewhere in the Old Testament, even only one person is ever identified as the captain of the armies of God. Jesus Christ. Joshua just met his match. Not a match in the sense of someone equal to him, but the one that he was typical of to come. What a strange thing happened at the school here a while back. Most of you know I work with a school up in Lubbock, Sunset International Bible Institute. And, you know, with so many people coming and going up there, occasionally we end up having two people with the same name. But one day, there in the offices next to where I work, a man who's a missionary to the Philippines had come in. He's back in the States for a little while, so he comes in, and he's talking with the secretary, getting something done, and his name is Charles Smith. Well, from across the street, one of our students comes across the street. His wife needs something, and so he's there to see the same secretary. And his name is Charles Smith. And wouldn't you know it, while they're both there, a third man named Charles Smith comes in, also associated with the school. So we have these three men all standing there talking to each other, all three of them named Charles Smith. Now, I don't think it went so far as their middle names being all the same. But what do we have here? We have Joshua talking to Joshua. We have Joshua meeting the one who's to come, still 1,000 years in the future, the captain of the armies of God. Joshua was the captain of the armies of Israel. But this was a captain of the armies of God. And we keep going through the books. Judges. The book of Ruth. Yes, we see him there. The book of Ruth, the story of a woman who husband dies and her two sons die, and she's left with her, just this woman, a widow, with her two daughters-in-laws who are also widows. And they don't know what they're going to do. And she eventually moves back to Israel. And her daughter-in-law meets a man, a Jewish man there, and marries him. Whoa, Jesus is all through that. Because the place they go is to Bethlehem, and the older widow who has a daughter-in-law who is also a widow is kin to a man named Boaz, who is of the tribe of Judah, a descendant of Judah. And after Boaz marries Ruth, they have a son who has a son who has a son whose name is David, who is the ancestor of Jesus. He's there. The shadow passes across Ruth. 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings, 1 and 2 Chronicles, Ezra, Nehemiah, even Esther, which we'll be talking about tonight in our lesson. The shadow of good things to come. It passes across the whole Old Testament. We'll take up the prophets next week and see his shadow pass across them. We need to realize that this is God's doing. And why would God shape and change and interfere with, if we want to use that term, and be involved with thousands of years of human history to put his stamp and his influence and his signature and his arrows and his signs on all these different things throughout of history? Unless it was the most important possible thing that could ever happen. So that when Jesus is born into the world, the heavens break out with the angels singing, and shepherds in the field see and hear what's going on. For God's great plan through all of history was now finding its fulfillment. He's come, that all of history had been pointing to. And now he has come. And he fulfilled his purpose in coming that first time and showing who he was and giving us God's law and God's word, and then dying on a cross as a sacrifice for our sins, raised from the dead to show us that death is not the end and that he has a power over death. And now he's ascended back to heaven, seated at the right hand of the throne of God. But it's not all over yet. He's coming back. And that will be the end of the world, not by water, but by fire. And he will judge the whole world. And he'll wrap all this present order of things up, and then we will pass into the heavenly. And God foretold it all as those shadows passed across the Old Testament.